his feet.
I am the riddle in the mouth of the Sphinx. I am the slaver that chews the living chain. I am the farmer of dead seeds, the filler of holes. Who am I?
Senlin answered at a whisper,
Death.
Yes, the red hand breathed.
An explosion arrested the tightening at Senlin's throat. The apartment window across from them blew out into the station yard. The blast came from the opposite side of the room, and they turned as one toward the origin. Illuminated by the light of the hall, Adam stood in the doorway with his second pistol raised. A troop of dock workers drummed up the stairs behind him. With unnatural speed, the assassin flung Senlin at the door, ruining any chance of Adam getting off a second shot. The red hand leapt through the jagged remains of the window into the murky light of the station yard and was gone. Adam caught Senlin, the pistols in his hand making for an awkward embrace. Senlin, his voice momentarily crushed, gestured at the devastated window. Adam didn't wait for further direction. He yelled over his shoulder at the coming troop of porters.
After him! He's headed for the port!
Adam propped Senlin on his heels and ran for the stairs, raising the alarm as he went. Senlin's bedroom looked like it had entertained a bull. Rubbing his raw throat, Senlin made a half-hearted attempt at gathering up his sundries and his clothes. He dropped the tangled mass into one of the broken drawers and shuffled to the heap that had once been a picture frame. His knees trembled when he knelt to the painted board, which miraculously had landed face up among the nest of wood and brown paper backing. The painting had survived. This simple fact was enough to chase the terror and the shock from his mind. He had also survived. He was surprised by the texture on the reverse side of the painted board. It felt like fish scales. The paper over back of the painting had been torn open. He turned the board over and let out an unexpected blat of laughter. Taped to the reverse side of the board and staring back at him was a girl. She stood in ankle-deep water. A paper boat dangled from her hand. A scrap of paper fell out. The few words on it had been written out hurriedly, but Senlin still recognized the hand. It was Ogier's. It said,
Don't let him have it. It's not what it seems. It is a key. It is a key to the tower, and happiness, and death. Hide it, and keep it safe, for her sake.
A half hour later, Adam returned to find the portmaster sitting on his bed with all the lights on. The gunny curtains hung limply over the destroyed window. Senlin had had the presence of mind to hide Ogier's contraband painting. Whatever happened, he was determined to not add to Adam's burden any further. It wouldn't do the young man any good to wrestle with the mystery of a painting that Senlin had been compelled to steal by a man who did not keep it, even while insisting that it was a key to the tower and happiness and death, whatever that meant. Such mysteries were part of the burden of leadership. Besides, Ogier's painting might turn out to be a bargaining chip yet, and he didn't want anyone to know that he had it, at least for the moment.
He got away, Adam said. We chased him to the port. Don't ask me how a man who glows in the dark vanishes in the middle of the night.
He tried to laugh, but the noise came out raw as a bray. Adam, badly shaken, sat heavily on a corner of Senlin's bed.
I've never seen anything like that. I don't know what that was.
Thank you for coming to the rescue,
Senlin said, recovering some of his usual ramrod posture.
It was either that or lie awake listening to you break every piece of furniture in your room,
Boreas said, with a tenuous smile. He was quiet for a while, his brow knitted in reflection. After a moment, he asked,
Tom, who was that?
Senlin wheezed, his swollen throat constricting his breath. It took him a few breaths to work up to saying,
That was the Red Hand, the Commissioner's executioner. I think it's clear that we're past bargaining with that tyrant.
He retrieved the broom that stood in a corner of his room and began sweeping up the shattered glass from under the window.
I'm afraid that my glowing assassin will be back, eventually. I'm glad you interrupted him when you did,
but he doesn't seem the sort to be discouraged for long.
Adam stood and pursued the portmaster as he shuffled about the floor, dragging the broom in long, pensive strokes.
Well, you say we're past bargaining, but you're also past hiding now. What are you going to do? If you have the painting, if you felt like you had to hide it from me, why hide it from him? Just give it to him. It's not worth dying for.
I agree, Senlin said, presenting the broom to Adam. And since you feel like pacing, I'll give you something to push.
Adam yanked the broom from Senlin's hand, but did not cease pleading his case.
Then tell him where the painting is. Tell him who has it and who you stole it for. Or tell me, and I'll talk to him on your behalf.
No. It's a brave offer. You probably don't realize how brave, but no. You're right about one thing. There'll be no more hiding. But for the time being, I think the Commissioner's uncertainty is what will keep me alive. The Red Hand could have just wrung me dead in my sleep. But no. He wanted to talk. I think, Adam, there is more to this painting than we know. I think the Commissioner is desperate to have it back and just as afraid to lose it, which I find interesting. And as long as I can keep him guessing...
Senlin trailed off when he saw Adam hanging upon the broom like an old crone holds her cane. He leaned on the broom, looking bereft of all hope. And why not? He had just seen a monster, full in the flesh. The peril was undeniable. Senlin strode to the table and picked up the jailer's key that lay there. He wanted to give Adam something else to distract him, something useful. So he said,
"All right. It's about time I learned how to reload a gun. Come and show me."
Adam gave him a long, disbelieving look, but the portmaster did not back away from the request, which had sounded remarkably like an order. After a moment, Adam set aside the broom and began the instruction. The next morning, driven by curiosity, Senlin went out on the pier and looked for how the assassin had escaped. A ship would have been noticed, even a small one, which meant the Red Hand had come by more discreet means. Scouting the perimeter of the dock turned up nothing suspicious, though he wasn't entirely sure what he expected to find. He repeated the circuit, twice, moving more slowly each time. The porters, waiting idly for new freight, were amused to see their portmaster out of his office and away from the station yard. They were further delighted to watch him sprawl flat and hang half over the side of the dock like a man who'd had too much to drink. Senlin ignored their snickers. It wasn't long before he found what he was looking for. A silk cord tied carefully to an eyelet screwed close to the edge on the underside of the pier. He couldn't see where the cord ended because it ran down and around the limb of the tower. But he was sure it led to the baths. The Red Hand had had a long and treacherous climb up, but a quick slide back down. Senlin set a hook knife to the cord and snipped the line. One thing was certain. Someone in the port of Gol had tied the line and let it out. Someone in New Babel was conspiring with the Commissioner. Later that morning, when Irene burst into his office, Senlin was prepared. He received her calmly, his hands steepled over the absurd prow of his desk. She stuck out her hand, large as a dinner plate, and waited for the envelope filled with bills and the summary of imports.
"You can't read," Senlin declared, "which means you can't write, which means you are more helpless than a woman of your stature should be."
The lines of her broad, smooth brow turned down, pointing toward a deep and frightening scowl. With practiced deliberation, she unlatched the chain about her waist. The links clanked as they straightened at her side. Senlin regarded all of this with a small, implacable smile. Irene adopted a fighting stance, the leather of her apron creaking about her trunk-like thighs, her feet nearly connecting the walls of the room. Senlin refused to flinch, even as she began to swing the chain over her head. The whoosh of the chain filled the narrow space. She let it out, link by link, until the hook at the end whizzed within inches of his bookcases. The tree of rubber stamps on his desk trembled. The beads of his abacus chattered. His papers fluttered. It was as if a storm had been born inside his office. Through it all, Senlin regarded her with level-eyed patience. He said,
"I've gotten used to having my life threatened, Irene. I'm bored with it. Knock my head off, or sit down."
Her face reddening, Irene turned the chain's propeller nearer the top of his head. Senlin felt his hair begin to part from the gust. He had to raise his voice to be heard over the wail of the chain.
"You can't punch the sense out of a book. You can't torture a letter into talking. You can't strangle a sign into giving you directions. Everywhere you look, there are secrets standing out in the open. You are vulnerable because of it. But I can help you, if you'll let me."
Gradually, her anger dwindled and her chain slowed, until, with a final jerk of her arm, she snapped the hook back to her hand. Breathing heavily, she wrapped the chain about her waist again.
"What do you want from me?"
she asked, in her mournful baritone.
"See this?"
Senlin turned up his chin to show the garish bruise collaring his throat.
"I need you to teach me how to keep this from happening. I've written a letter to Gol, asking him to let you train me to defend myself. I think he'll want to keep his investment, that is, me, from getting strangled in his sleep. I'm sure you've heard about last night."
Irene inspected the bruise with the vague interest of a connoisseur. She didn't seem overly impressed.
"An hour a day," Senlin continued crisply. "We'll spend the first half hour sparring and the second reading. What do you say?"
"Mr. Gall won't like me wasting time on books."
"Then don't tell him," Senlin said, holding out the letter he prepared. "He's the least of our worries. I'm going to feel very weak, and you're going to feel very dumb. But that's how it always is in the beginning. Learning starts with failure."
Irene scrutinized the face of the clear-eyed stick-man sitting before her, searching for signs of shrewdness or pity, any trace of which would have brought her down on him like a guillotine. Making up her mind, she nodded and said,
"Okay."
She grabbed the letter and pounded from the room. It was the longest conversation he'd ever held with her. Chapter 11 The Double Fond is a pot-bellied galleon with an S-shaped hull, 8 long guns, 3 fat envelopes, a grappling cannon, a glorious deckhouse, a great cabin complete with teardrop chandelier, and a crew of 62 armed marauders. All dreaming aside, a ship is only as good as her course. I must find a new wind. Every Man's Tower, One Man's Travails, by T. Senlin. He had ulterior motives for tutoring Irene. Senlin knew she was capable of doing the work of 2 men, and he wanted her on his crew. But buying her loyalties would require more, much more than he could afford. Since he could not hope to buy her loyalty, he meant to earn it. So her lessons began. Mid-afternoon, behind the closed door of his office, stooped over the primer he'd written out for her, Senlin treated her exactly as he had the illiterate bullies of his past school days, with patient and firm encouragement. At first, she held the pen like a knife and attacked the paper. She bent and snapped nib after nib and shot black spiders of ink across the page. It was days before she could even close the loops of her letters, though every day she destroyed fewer pages and pens. Every day she improved. And he learned that she was not entirely illiterate. Her education was sped along by her familiarity with a few essential words. She could read the common labels of crates and the regular verbs that appeared on broadside advertisements. She proved to be a quick study and took her lessons in earnest. She practiced on her own, and within a week she could read rudimentary sentences. Senlin found her determination inspiring. Irene's patience was not inexhaustible. She suffered fits of frustration. At the peak of her frustrations, she would accuse Senlin of making up rules, of contradicting himself, of mocking her attempts at sounding out words. More than once she grabbed whatever was at hand, an inkpot or paperweight, and raised it menacingly over her tutor's head. But he carried on explaining the logic of the grammar in the same calm, lilting tone.
"See, the J jumps back while the L lays the way.
Try again. John likes to beat the drum. Lisa likes to ring the bell. Eventually, Irene would lower her makeshift weapon, and her halting efforts would resume. And she always got her revenge. At least, Senlin suspected that their sparring lessons in the station yard were coloured by her irritation with her education. Her preferred method of teaching Senlin to defend himself was by attacking him relentlessly, until, inevitably, he ended up flat on his back, winded and bruised. Then, as she watched him struggle to his feet, she would explain with the fewest words possible what he had done wrong. When they sparred with stuffs and she swept his legs from under him, she said,
"Your feet are too close together."
When they boxed and Senlin was left doubled over from three quick jabs to the stomach, she said,
"You wind up your punches."
When they practiced with wooden swords and she clipped him on the ear, she said,
"Don't attack my sword, attack me."
It was a humiliating process, made more so by the crowd their practice attracted. The men of the yard gathered about the sparring ring they cleared between crates of olives and kegs of vinegar. At first, the porters observed the lessons casually, afraid to gawk at their portmaster and Finn Gull's enforcer scrapping in the yard. But soon, their observations grew more focused and vocal. There were exclamations, which became volleys, which became cheers of the sort one might hear around a professional ring. By the end of the first week of their afternoon bouts, wagers were being made. An enterprising stevedore found a cracked slate and began chalking up the odds. Senlin tried to ignore the nature of the bets. They presumed he would be overwhelmed by Irene's size and ability. It was a given that he would end up on his back. The bets regarded how long he would stay on his feet and whether he would ever land a successful parry or punch. Even those odds were bad. But he was learning. For the first time in his life, he felt like he was developing his reflexes. He began to sense the rhythms and patterns of her assaults. Strength, he discovered, was not as important as balance, and balance was not as important as anticipation. He began to predict some of her attacks by the slight shifts in her stance or the tightening of her shoulders. He could sometimes anticipate the trajectory of her foot or staff, even if he couldn't always get out of the way of the blow. Occasionally, he'd enjoy a little success, a dodge or parry, and immediately afterward would begin to analyze his success. He'd ponder how fighting had a grammar all its own, and war had its syntax. His mind wandered. These flights of fancy always resulted in him being laid out.
"Don't think about it so much," Irene said,
after one of Senlin's daydreams had been punctuated by her delivery of an unexpected uppercut.
"Better not think at all."
So it was they developed camaraderie out of necessity. The whole arrangement made Adam nervous. He tried to convince his friend that Irene was a monster playing the pet. "Don't believe for a moment that you are friends," Adam said one afternoon, while washing out a large abrasion on Senlin's shoulder blade. The portmaster had earned it while attempting to strike his teacher with a graceless riposte. Instead of landing the blow with his wooden dowel, he'd thrown himself off balance and had slid painfully across the gravel yard. Though injured, Senlin felt pride in the attempt, which Irene deemed
gutsy.
"She can be swayed," Senlin told Adam, and believed it. Air currents, Senlin had learned from his readings on the subject, were similar to sea currents. They were invisible but persistent conveyor belts of varying widths and strengths. They braided the sky in intricate systems of energy. Airships, at least those that came to the port of Gol, had no means of self-propulsion, and, much like a sail, were entirely reliant on the wind for speed and direction. Ships could be moved vertically by warming the trapped gas or releasing ballast, allowing them to leap from one current to another. Captains, at least capable ones, had some measure of control over their course. The locations of the ports that jutted from the tower had been chosen for their proximity to relatively calm, stable currents. Well-placed ports were reliably accessible, but the trade-off was that many could only be entered and exited along a single course. This posed no inconvenience to righteous traders,
but it made hijacking docked ships a risky business. Running away was easy enough, but getting away would be hard. If Senlin and his as-yet-imaginary crew on their as-yet-imaginary ship hoped to get very far, a novel escape route was essential. So, to the amusement of the aeronauts and dock workers, Senlin took up a new morning hobby. As the rising sun sparkled upon the frost-slicked port, Senlin paced behind the white wax-paper kite that he had built. The pinch of the autumnal air had given way to the bite of winter. The sky was as cold and flat as a frozen sea. He flew his kite between the enormous balloons that tugged at moored ships. The kite dove like a sparrow along the curving face of the tower, battering its corners against pink sandstone. It tangled about the yardarms of cranes, and he'd have to climb to free it. He lost his hold on many kites while stumbling over crates and bales of cargo, and could only watch helplessly as the plain diamonds fled into the distance. The men laughed. The bitter wind stung, and always his kites flew eastward on the same persistent current of wind. The trade wind. The only wind. After a couple of days of lost kites and stubbed toes, Senlin found what he was looking for. It happened one morning when the dock was unusually empty. Senlin had given the dock workers the previous evening off, after a two-day lull in traffic, and most of the men were sleeping off their drunken liberty. Above, a long, shallow depression in the facade of the tower seemed to attract the kite. The dip in the tower face would have seemed little more than a dimple from a distance, but locally it was large enough to generate a little vacuum. The kite tugged intermittently at the spool in Senlin's hand, reminding him of how a fishing line would dip and jerk with the explorative bumps of a cautious fish. Then, all at once, the kite took off, flying straight up the face of the tower for 50 feet before pulling sharply west. His line exhausted, Senlin held the last foot of silk, watching the kite fight to follow the newly discovered current. Then he let it go. Watching the kite escape on that untapped current charmed a smile to his face. It would be a little difficult to reach, and missing the edge of the current would probably result in the ship being dashed against the stone face. But he had found his course. Hazardous as it was, he had found his exit. Adam did not receive the news of the miraculous discovery with the enthusiasm Senlin had hoped for. Senlin found his friend in the gloomy damp of the station yard, under the skating bats and egg-yolk lights, trying to pry the lid from a stubbornly shut crate. When his crowbar slipped out and nearly caught him in the chin, Adam, in an unusual display of anger, began beating the crate furiously.
"Why?"
Adam asked, once he had exhausted himself.
"Why seal up a box of pears like it was a coffin?"
Senlin laid a hand on his friend's heaving shoulder.
"It's just fruit. What's got you so mad?"
The crowbar clanged out three notes as it bounced on the ground.
"Rodion," he said with concerted calm. "He's squeezing the last pence out of me. In the past 3 weeks, he's come to me with 3 marriage contracts for Valita. Each time I give him a mina to delay the agreement, and he goes away to find a new husband in waiting with a fatter wallet. I'm out of money."
He picked up the crowbar and reset its claw under the lip of the lid. "Valita says she should break a leg or set her hair on fire. She thinks that no one would want to marry a gimpy, bald girl. But that's the trouble. The only thing keeping her out of the bedroom is the stage. But it's her act that attracts the lechers. I'm afraid that I'll just wake up one morning and she'll be gone for good." The lid finally came open with a squeal of nails. Adam shook the soreness out of his arms and plucked a blushing pear from the bed of straw.
"So, I'm glad you found your wind, Tom, but I don't see how we're any closer to getting out of this place."
"I will talk to Rodion," Senlin said.
"And say what?"
Before Senlin could answer, their conversation was interrupted by the arrival of a familiar auto wagon. The ebony panels of the coach were like black mirrors, fluted with gold leaf. The windows were lidded with blood-coloured shades, and the brass and copper stack of the machine spilled wads of steam over the gaunt driver. Fingal's auto wagon cleared a path through the porters in the yard as effortlessly as a shark through a school of sardines. Senlin hadn't seen much of the port's namesake in the 3 months he'd worked as the man's portmaster. His unexpected appearance now might be nothing more than a surprise inspection, but Senlin was certain that Gol hadn't come to the port on a social call. Senlin catalogued the worst-case scenarios. Gol had learned about the raise Senlin had given the workers, and had come to squeeze compensation out of the portmaster's hide. Or Gol had deduced the interest behind the midnight attempt on Senlin's life, and was preparing now to turn him over to the commissioner and collect the ransom. Or the Lord of Port had somehow caught wind of Senlin and Adam's plot, and was coming now to mete out the punishment that came to all deserters. The plank. Irene preceded Gol out the door of the coach. Her shoulders, usually squared, were now slumped. It was a bad sign. Worse, she didn't meet Senlin's eye when he came to meet the carriage. Gol emerged onto the running board where he stayed, standing nearly at eye level with Senlin. The driver did not shut off the engine, making it clear their business would be brief.
Irene has developed some new talents.
Gol put his hand on Irene's head in the familiar way that a boy might handle his dog.
"Imagine my surprise this morning when I find her writing this," he said, producing a page from his vest pocket.
He unfolded it and began to read in the mocking tone of a simpleton.
"John likes to beat the drum. Lisa likes to ring the bell. John and Lisa march and sing all around the wooded dell."
Senlin recognized the verse as having come from his primer, and he quickly deduced where this conversation was heading. Gol had correctly identified the lessons as a threat to his authority, and he had come out to reassert that authority.
"Tom, can you imagine how useful it was to have a secure, reliable, untroubled messenger? Who wants a dog that can read what it fetches? Now I find I'm in the uncomfortable position of having to trust my courier."
Gol pulled a second slip of paper from his pocket. This, with a flourish of the wrist, he gave to the Amazon.
"And since trust requires trials, Irene, dearie, please read the directions I've given you."
She studied the scrap of paper, her brow furrowing with the effort. The words came in fits and starts.
"Make a fist with your hand, and put it to Tom's head 3 times.
"That last word is times, dearie. Seems you didn't enact such a miracle after all, Tom."
Gol drew a whistling breath. Irene stood in a stupor, staring down at the note in her hands. Senlin watched as she grappled with the decision, and he found himself silently willing her to strike him before it was too late. Gol was testing her loyalty. She had to strike before suspicion set in. She recovered herself in an instant. Stepping forward, she took Senlin by the collar and, without ceremony, struck him in the face again and again and again. The only mercy she paid him was to spread her blows evenly across his head, and still it felt like the kick of a mule.
"Hold there, Irene! That's good! That's 5! I only asked for 3!
Gol was greatly amused by the extra blows. Senlin's face streaked with blood and tears. Irene dropped him, and he fell right through his knees to his tailbone. He bounced against the ground and spilled onto his back. The world was haloed in red, and at the center was Gol's round face.
"Tom, you would have done well to have taught her to count before you began the alphabet," Gol said. "At our age, education is a waste. You can't defend yourself, she can't count, and I can't learn to trust. We're too deep in our roots to turn onto fresh tracks. In the future, I'd appreciate it if you didn't meddle with the natural order of things."
He disappeared back into the carriage. Then, through the window, he concluded,
"And another thing, Tom. I expect that men who make it this far up the tower will come with a little baggage. But if what I've heard is true, and it was the Red Hand who came a-callin' last month, I want nothing to do with it. The Commissioner and his thug aren't to be trifled with. Whatever it is, sort it out. I don't want to lose my bookkeeper because of some grudge. But at the same time, I'm not sticking my neck out for you. If the Commissioner decides to press the point, I'll hang you out to dry.
Gold's parting words resonated through Senlin's pain. If Gold didn't know why the Red Hand had come, he couldn't know about the painting. Which meant he hadn't been the one to turn Senlin in. It made sense, of course. Gol had no reason to be subtle. If he had wanted to collect the bounty, he would have done it openly and immediately. Finn Gol might be a heartless boss, but he wasn't the one trying to get Senlin killed. But if not Gol, then who? Gol rapped on the door twice, and the driver let out the throttle. As the coach pulled away, Irene grabbed the rear rail and pulled herself into the jump seat. She glanced back at Senlin briefly. There was a subtle shift in her expression, which would have gone undetected by anyone who hadn't spent hours sitting across from her. To Senlin, that look spoke volumes. She was unhappy. Perhaps the beating had driven her nearer to his cause. Chapter 12. Everything I've read on the subject suggests that 5 able bodies are required to make a skeletal crew. Counting myself, Adam and Valita, and presuming that I can recruit Irene, I'm still one short. I suppose I could advertise in the station yard. Aeronaut wanted for crusade into certain peril and probable death. Low wages, moral reward, philanthropists preferred. Every man's tower, one man's travails. By T. Senlin. The thin winter air felt good on his bruised face. The snowy mountain range on the horizon looked like a long sheet of torn paper. The market below had begun to take on a unified colour, as tents, carts and travellers were all smudged by distance into a textured mauve. His aero-rod thumped upon the iron-bound wood beams of the skyport, striking a tone and rhythm the men recognised. Senlin could easily tell which porters only became busy at his approach. The hardest workers moved slowly, deliberately, while the lazy appeared eternally fresh and enthusiastic. But Senlin wasn't out to inspect the men. He had come to look at ships. He was well aware of how strained the situation had become in recent days. He would lose Adam if they couldn't save Valita from Rodion soon, and Irene might like him, but Finn Gol would be watching her closely now, and Senlin doubted she would abandon her life just to continue her reading lessons. Gol had made it clear that there was a limit to his patience. He might at any moment decide that Senlin was a greater liability than an asset. Senlin couldn't afford to be picky now. Today he would choose a ship. Tomorrow he would steal it. The port was full, at least. All 4 slips were occupied. The Cornelius sat in the towerside South Bay, a hulking, multi-tiered ship that reminded Senlin of a great flat-bottomed riverboat. Its boiler room alone probably required 3 men to maintain. Though it hardly mattered, the ship was scheduled to cast off before nightfall. Across from it sat a grey wind-scalded ship called the Stone Cloud. It was not much larger than a 12-man sloop, and oddly shaped. Its hull was reminiscent of a nesting robin, with a bulbous fore and a flattened aft. It had 1 30-pound gun at the bowsprit, a filthy, clam-shaped balloon, and a full crew of gold-toothed pirates. The outer North Bay held a miserable, unarmed ferry christened the Sally Quick, which looked as sturdy as a rat's nest and every bit as charming. Then there was the Gold Finch, a sleek merchant ship from the south of the continent that had come in loaded with olives, tea, pistachios, and incense. Freshly painted a brilliant yellow, the Finch had 4 big guns and a single long envelope that was tapered like a cigar. It was a little large for a 5-man crew, but manageable, he thought. He stood atop a coffee crate, considering the Gold Finch. This was the ship, his ship. Now he only had to figure out some way to empty it. He tried to discreetly count the heads of the crew as they moved along the immaculately scrubbed deck. He had just lost count and had started again, when he heard someone speak his name. It was a woman's voice, a familiar voice. He turned and found Edith standing behind him with a wondering expression on her face. His second thought was that it was not Edith. This woman's dark hair was bobbed above the jawline. She wore the mismatched leathers and rough wool pants popular among unaffiliated aeronauts, which was just a polite way of saying pirates. A piece of polished brass capped her right shoulder like a lone scrap of plate armour. This rustic privateer was nothing like the countrywoman in a peach gown who'd once huddled and shivered against him while locked inside a wire coop. It could not be her. And yet, it was. Since she had spied him first, she had the unfair advantage of having composed herself. A lopsided smile bunched the freckles on one dusky cheek, and she held her head cocked in a mischievous manner, as if she'd been trying to sneak up on him. He recovered himself quickly, and since he was unsure how to react, he stayed poised atop the crate, like a statue in a town square.
"What are you doing here?" he asked. "Well, hello to you too, Tom," she said, feeling, or perhaps feigning, hurt.
Senlin softened his tone.
"I beg your pardon. I only meant—"
His mind drifted back to their days in the cage, a memory he had long suppressed. With no further prodding, the whole ordeal came rushing back, swamping him with unaddressed guilt and an uncomfortable ache. He had left her, in her hour of need, with a sadistic nurse and a fresh wound. While he'd escaped with scratches, she had been maimed. She had every right to hold a grudge.
"You're supposed to be farming."
Her smirk stiffened at that. She didn't seem to enjoy the reference to her past life. When she replied, it came out as a jab.
"And you're supposed to be teaching brats and making some of your own. How is your wife?"
It was his turn to be wounded now. His expression, he was sure, betrayed everything, but he felt compelled to confess it anyway.
"I haven't found her. Not yet."
"Oh," Edith said, and flinched with her silent self-rebuke. Their unexpected reunion was going terribly. Senlin began to think of an excuse for a quick exit. A dock worker, gesturing sheepishly at the crate under Senlin's feet, interrupted the clumsy moment. He asked,
"Are you done with that one, portmaster? It's for the truck, if you are."
Senlin climbed stiffly down, not letting the dock worker see his broken composure.
Yes, take it, he said.
Standing level with her, he realized that she was not wearing a brass pauldron, as he'd first thought. Her shoulder armor ran all the way down her arm and ended in an intricately jointed gauntlet. He glanced at the metal arm, then to her charcoal eyes, then back to it, attempting not to gawk and failing. She gave an unguarded laugh.
"Poor master! Headmaster! Are you a master wherever you go?"
"Hardly," he snorted. "I was conscripted into it, but I'm not terrible at it. They haven't lynched me yet, anyway."
"That's a fine standard of excellence. I'm a first mate myself," she said, swelling a little with pride.
Senlin no longer wanted to bolt, but he was having trouble not staring at her brass-sheathed arm.
"Oh, really? That's an admirable title. Which ship are you mate of?"
"The Stone Cloud," she said, hiking ahead toward the vessel bobbing in its crib behind her. Senlin followed the motion and gave the ship he had previously dismissed a second examination. It looked like something that had lain submerged in a bog for years. The wood that formed the hull appeared to still have its bark. Or perhaps it was just some sort of aggressive burl. He wasn't sure.
"Why do people always make that face when I introduce them to my ship?" she said, interrupting his scrutiny. "It's not a bad ship, Tom. It's fast enough."
He cleared his throat.
I'm sure. "And how's the crew?" "Oh, I had to break them in. They weren't used to having a woman aboard, and it took a little while to convince them that I wasn't the ship's madam or anyone's mother." "All right. We might as well address it, since you're not going to stop gawking at it."
He had been caught looking for signs of skin between the metal joints of her armoured arm. Now he tried to act as if it was purely an academic interest.
"It's just such an unusual—"
he swallowed noisily.
"Ornament. How does it attach to the arm?"
"It doesn't," she said, with the aloofness of one who has entered a necessary but uncomfortable spiel.
I lost the arm to gangrene 6 months ago. It was removed just short of the shoulder. Edith studiously avoided Senlin's gaze, which embarrassed him more because he wanted to reach out through his stare and offer some solace. But her shying also saved her from having to watch his initial revulsion turn to anger and then to pity, all in the span of a few seconds.
Yes. The infection started with the branding, and no, I won't talk about it.
Sensing how uncomfortable she'd become, Senlin made a concerted effort to return his attention to the arm. It was truly a marvel, as sophisticated as a wind-up bird and as solid as a derrick. A beautiful arabesque pattern ran down the length of the arm, like a tribal tattoo. When she flexed the arm for him, a valve at the shoulder gave a little puff of steam, fine as pollen shaken from a bloom. Clockworks hummed inside the brass shell as her digits unfurled one by one. She demonstrated the fluid and nearly human range of her fingers by reaching out and unbuttoning the top button of his coat. It was a forward thing to do, and it made Senlin briefly flinch, and then, very soon after, laugh. He was relieved to find that the bold woman he'd met in the parlour had not been eclipsed by her novel limb or humble ship.
"It's a demanding little engine," she said. "I have to put water in it. I have to oil it and fuel it. I've owned prize thoroughbreds that needed less attention. And it didn't come cheap, I'll tell you that. New arms aren't free, Tom. You have to make a deal."
She bent and scooped up a pine slat from a broken pallet. She squared the wood board in her mechanical palm and, with a slight jerk, crushed the board to splinters.
"But the damnedest deals have the damnedest perks."
Realizing that she was trying to make him recoil, Senlin refused to indulge her. He ignored the menacing nature of her demonstration and instead complimented her on it.
"It is incredible. It reminds me, oddly, of a music box with its thick, hearty drum and its delicate comb. It's part hammer and part tweezers, isn't it? But I am sorry. I'm so terribly sorry that it came at such an awful cost. Edith, it is—"
She dropped the arm abruptly and hiked her chin at him.
"Ha! You remembered my name after all," she said. "Of course I remember your name. You're the generaless of the garden, Mrs. Mayfair with a fist. You're Miss Edith X. Winters. I didn't forget."
She slouched a little, looking almost vulnerable, though the splintered board lay still fresh at her feet.
"It seems like everyone I meet knows nothing about me, but still wants something from me. It's so tiring, Tom, to always be on your guard. It's been an exhausting 6 months."
"It has," Senlin agreed, and stamped down the guilt that was already bawling inside him. Could he pretend to be any different? Didn't he want something from her, too? She looked around, appearing uncomfortable with the conversation, and said,
"I have to go kick my crew softly in the pants. We have a half-ton of eggs to unload, and if I don't glare at them while they do it, they'll break half of them, and then blame your porters for it."
Senlin nodded, his hands wrenching his aero-rod nervously.
"When do you shove off?"
"Tomorrow. The crew has shore leave tonight."
"Oh. Well, then, maybe we could have dinner together," Senlin said.
"I can't. First mate has to stay aboard so the captain can go carousing. Besides, I don't care for the local entertainment much."
"No, of course," Senlin said.
"But could I call on you? I have a bottle of very average port that has been aging on a shelf for days now. It really needs to be drunk." She laughed, but he could feel the hesitation in the sidelong way she looked at him. Perhaps she was thinking of his wife and wondering if this was some sort of romantic overture, or perhaps she already sensed that he too wanted something from her. The months had made her guarded, but she didn't waffle for long.
"Bring your port, portmaster. If it needs to be drunk, we'll drink it. I'll be free after moonrise."
Senlin watched her stride off toward the stone cloud that squatted like a molting bird in its nest. The flawless gold finch swelled grandly behind him. He heaved a sigh. Yes, her ship was plain, short on guns, probably infested with termites, and aptly named. But the stone cloud had one very appealing quality, and she, unlike the rest of them, was familiar with airships. While he'd been mastering another man's ledgers, she learned how to fly. So it had to be the stone cloud. This was the ship. Already feeling a little devious, though he had done nothing yet and was not exactly sure what he would do once given the chance, Senlin arrived back in his office to find that he had company. The yellow-haired woman sat in his desk chair with a book in hand. She appeared to be reading what he recognized as a particularly inept guide to the tower. On closer inspection, he realized she was not reading the book. She was scouring it with the nib of a pen. She scratched at the pages with such determination that it seemed she was trying to dig through it. Then he recalled where he'd seen this odd behavior before. The postal clerk in the baths had been likewise engaged with the book Senlin had rescued, The Confidences of a Wife-Monger. When the yellow-haired woman saw Senlin stalled in the doorway, she did not immediately cease her work. Instead, she laid the book out for him so that he could see the words she was carefully redacting, beginning from the last word on the last page and working her way toward the start. He recognized her as one of Rodian's girls, but he didn't show it. Instead, he said, "Put down my book! Get out of my chair!" This she did, though with a sarcastic pout that made it clear she was only humoring him. She circled around one side of his desk as he came around the other. Plopping into the cracked red chair across from him, she said,
"You have a lot of stupid things."
"Yes," he said coldly, picking up his scribbled-upon book with unfelt reverence.
"Do stupid things attract you? Oh, you have a mouth. You think reading books makes you smart, but it just fills you with so much stupidness."
"Yes," he said again. "It's an interesting habit you have. What do you call it when you scrawl out the words of a book? You must have a name for it. Desecration? Doodling?"
"Course not. It's called studying."
"Ah, studying, of course. And why do you start from the end and study your way backward?" She sucked her teeth.
"To keep from reading, of course. The words worm their way in, even if you don't know what they say. They speak to you in your head, and you hear it."
Senlin sighed at the idiocy of this, but filed the information away for later consideration. At the moment, he had to focus on the task at hand, which began with getting her out of his office. He set aside the ruined book. "What do you want?"
"You don't remember me," she said, with sinister coyness, her chin dropping to her neck.
She had a pretty, pert face, and her bosom bunched against an over-tightened corset, but there was nothing appealing about her. She radiated vanity and cruelty.
"But I remember you."
"You were on the barge," Senlin interjected. "And at the steam pipe, I remember."
"Oh, no, no, no. Before that, on the piano. You looked at my legs, and I showed you a little more, and then you looked all offended, like I was some sort of floozy. Remember? Then you made such a scene with all your sneezing. The commissioner put on his rubber mask and took you out onto the porch, and you, Mr. Sneezy, had some words with him. Then, not 3 days later, you're on the floozy barge with your nose in the air, flying to the boudoir with all the whores you're too good for. It's funny. How does a man go from big talk with the commissioner to the floozy barge in a few days? Maybe he's running away from something, I think. Maybe he's gotten into someone else's honey, eh? What do you think? You think I'm stupid because I'm honest? Honest here?" she said, waving provocatively at her décolletage.
She raised a leg and put her slippered foot on the edge of his desk, her skirt spilling up about her white thigh.
"And honest here?"
Senlin kept his stare locked with her own, refusing to acknowledge the display.
"But I'm not stupid."
She dropped her foot with a little stamp.
"I know who you are, and I know you're in it deep."
Senlin's initial surprise at her familiarity with his past in the baths had time to fade during her prattling speech, and had now resolved into a rehearsal of the facts. She knew him. She was trying to extort money from him. She was clever enough to see an opportunity, but not clever enough to know what to do with it. Otherwise, she would have gone to the commissioner. Instead, she had come to him, hoping that he would startle and attempt to bribe her. But it was apparent to Senlin now that she worked for the very man who had sold him out to the commissioner. It was the only thing that made sense. Rodion had influence and was ambitious. He had steady access to news from the baths, and he had his eyes in the port, to be sure. Rodion would not include Gol because he would not want to share the purse, and the attack had only come after Senlin's visit to the steampipe. The whoremonger had been curious about Senlin's pedigree. It wouldn't have taken much to discover Senlin's past entanglements. A few questions of the lonely captains who regularly visited the steampipe, a careful tentative letter to the customs bureau, or perhaps an evening frittered at a gala, and everything would be revealed. But if that was the case, why was Senlin still alive, and whole, and left alone? Why had the Red Hand not returned? Senlin knew that a snipped line would not be enough to detour the assassin for long, especially if he had willing accomplices running free in the port of Gol. Something was keeping Senlin safe, at least for the moment. Once he thought about it, the answer seemed obvious. It was the painting. No one knew where Ogier's painting was, and that was the real object, the real prize. If they killed him or dragged him off in the night, the painting might be lost forever. The commissioner would get his revenge, but not his treasure back. Perhaps all Rodion was waiting for was a definite target. If Rodion, for example, believed that the painting was about to be smuggled from the port on a particular pirate ship, he would feel compelled to retrieve the prize for the commissioner. He would be forced to act. He would storm the port with as many men as he could gather and demand to inspect the ships. And that would mean... The plan came to Senlin fully finished in a flash. Rodion was suspicious. Fingol was suspicious. Both expected conspiracy, and given one, would believe it. All that remained was to set the two against each other in his favour, to his own ends. Senlin smiled at the yellow-haired woman in a manner that he hoped appeared sufficiently nervous. "Look, I don't want my past bobbing to the surface again. I certainly don't want Rodion to know about it."
"And there's the plum, love. Quiet don't come cheap."
"Ah, money, yes. I have a lot of money coming to me, I'm sure, but I don't have it yet." He swallowed with affected anxiousness. "I have to move a thing of great value first. It's worth a fortune, and I'm smuggling it out tomorrow night." She squinted at him and formed her lips into a perfect red raisin.
"How dumb do you think I am? You're just going to run off with your treasure as soon as I turn around."
"No. Please, don't tell Rodion. I'll give you what I have now, and then more later." Senlin opened a desk drawer, drew out a little change purse, and tipped it onto his blotter. 6 pitiful shekels spilled out. It would be taken as an insult, he was sure, but he looked at her with sham hopefulness. "Take it. I'll have more after tomorrow. Just not a word to Rodion, please." The yellow-haired woman chewed at her lower lip, regarding him with a mean, deadened gaze.
"Yeah, okay."
She swept the coins into her hand and turned to leave. "Not a word," Senlin repeated.
"Oh, you'll get what you paid for, don't you worry. You'll get exactly what you paid for."
She gave another tart purse of her lips. Sweeping from the room, she did not see Senlin roll his eyes. Adam passed the blonde woman in the hall and came into Senlin's office with a thumb pointed over his shoulder and a perplexed expression on his face.
"Entertaining guests?"
Senlin motioned for him to close the door. He was having trouble containing a grin. When Adam was seated and settled, with the brow over his active eye raised in question, Senlin explained. "She is going to tell Rodion that I am up to something."
"Well, that doesn't sound good."
"No, it is very good. She recognized me from the baths, and I just told her that I'm smuggling something very valuable out of the port tomorrow night."
Rodion is not one to run off half-cocked on a rumour, so he'll need a little extra goading if he's going to empty our ship for us, and that's where you come in.
Our ship?
Wait, you found a ship? Adam said, craning forward.
A good ship?
A realistic conquest?
Yes.
The Stone Cloud, Senlin said, lacing his hands behind his head. It's a beautiful, rustic sloop, and I know the first mate, as it turns out.
What do you mean, you know the first mate?
I know her. We shared a prison cell for a few days.
Of course you did, Adam said, blinking through a daze.
Wait, what do you want me to do with Rodion?
You're going to rat me out to him, Senlin said it, as if it were the most sensible thing in the world.
You're going to lend credence to the rumouring of floozies.
Adam's confusion contorted his expression. He looked as if he'd been caught mid-sneeze.
Thomas, I don't think this is a very good...
No, it is. Everyone here expects everyone else to be treacherous. So, let's give them treachery. You will tell Rodion that, in exchange for the immediate liberation of your sister, you will reveal my whole conspiracy. Well, not all of it, of course. The main thing he needs to believe is that I have something of great value. You don't need to say what. He'll know. Which I'm frantically trying to smuggle out of the port, and that the whole debacle is taking place tomorrow night. Then you... Adam interrupted.
Why would he know what you're smuggling?
Because I am certain that he is the one who first contacted the Commissioner and brought the Red Hand down upon me. He knows all about the painting, and I'm sure he's just waiting for it to come into the open. Tell him I am smuggling out something worth a fortune, and let him travel to the conclusion himself. The less you seem to know, the safer you'll be. What matters most is that you come with him to the port, and you insist that Valita come too. Don't let him dissuade you from that point. Talk Rodion into letting you both come. I think he'll want to do it. He'll want to confront me with your betrayal. He'll enjoy that.
So you do have the painting?
It doesn't matter if I have the painting.
What do you mean it doesn't matter?
Nothing matters more than that fact. Either you have it, and we can bargain for our lives, or you don't, and we will be strung up from the yardarms. What are you going to do when Rodion doesn't find the bait we used to draw him out?
A very good point, which brings me to the next chore on your list. After you've gone to betray me to Rodion, you will send a message to Fingal and tell him that Rodion is going to conduct an unauthorized seizure of goods in the port of Gaul tomorrow night. Tell Gaul that Rodion is using his hold on Valita to force you into scouting for treasure ships.
For treasure ships?
Are you mad?
Well, whatever.
Tell him that Rodion is using you to find a vulnerable, valuable ship to plunder. Whatever you do, don't mention the Commissioner or the painting.
Adam shook his head like a man who's just suffered a blow to it.
This is your plan.
Calm down, Senlin said, easing his friend back from his rising mania with a softened tone.
I know it sounds a little ragged, but our best chance of escape is to set the egos against each other.
He brought his fists together in demonstration.
If Rodion and Gaul are fighting, they will be weakened and distracted. They won't think of us. We can slip away.
Trust me, Adam. This could work. An empty ship, your sister at the port, all of us ready to go.
Adam brooded over this for a moment and then said,
But you do have the painting.
I have, at least, a very compelling painting-sized crate, Senlin said, with a wink.
The chair feet squealed upon the floor as Adam stood. He pulled his shirt straight. His face reflected the grim resolve of one who has been asked to walk to his own execution. He nodded once and said,
Aye, aye, Captain.
Then strode from the room.
Chapter 13 Mirrors are not so honest as one might think. They can be mugged at, bargained with, and one can always ferret out a flattering angle. Really, There is nothing like the expression of a long-lost friend to reflect the honest state of your affairs. Every Man's Tower, One Man's Travails, by T. Senlin.